Tim Bertolotti, I want to talk to you about one of my favorite human beings in the whole world, Governor Deval Patrick. I just think the guy is wonderful. What do the people of Massachusetts think of him?
They have his favorability and job approval ratings are still pretty strong for someone in the middle of his second term. And there's a tremendous amount of speculation as to where he goes from here. His term is up in 2014. He's already said he won't seek another term. He spent a great deal of time as a surrogate for President Obama on the campaign trail in this cycle, and it's led to all sorts of speculation about what his next move might be.
Well, he's told me, in no uncertain terms, I have to go make some money now. So whether or not that's coyness or whether or not it's absolutely true, you know, I don't know. But the thing that, of course, gets me is when the president of the United States calls somebody like Deval Patrick on the phone and says, Deval, my friend, my surrogate, you know, the guy who has always been there for me, I really need you to come in and be attorney general of the United States now. What would he do?
It's a question better put to him, but I think he'd be hard-pressed to say no. This was a position that he was in the running for. At least that was the informed speculation at the beginning of President Obama's first term. And there is some talk in Washington that Eric Holder, he may not want to leave as Attorney General, but it might be time for a shuffle in terms of...
Yeah, he's had some rough go there.
He has, and this would take away one of the lightning rods that House Republicans have been focusing on with their investigation into the Fast and Furious gun distribution and how that fell apart along the border with Mexico. And so this would solve a couple of problems at the same time. It would help to reinvigorate the cabinet, and it would provide one less target of investigation, perhaps, for the House Republicans. So there is that speculation in terms of Governor Patrick.
There's another one that I have, and that's the Supreme Court of the United States. One time I was with him at a fundraising event. He saw my hat, my WMC hat. He took it off. He put it on. I came out and I introduced him and I said, and here's the next Supreme Court justice. He came out. He took the hat off. He put it back on my head. He says, I don't want this. I'm only running for one thing, he said, and that's governor.
Well, sure.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, that was his point. But it would not be unknown for a guy like that to be put onto the Supreme Court. He's brilliant. He's been in the private sector, which would make him maybe not attractive to the Republicans, but difficult to say no to.
That's right. That's right. And he has served in the Justice Department in the past as well.
Sure.
And with the outcome of this election, the Democrats have a couple of votes to work with in their majority. They'd have to, you know, there's still the possibility that Republicans could filibuster the nomination.
Oh,
but
yeah.
We don't see that as often with Supreme Court nominees as we do with other presidential nominees. And so it's inevitable, I think, that his name would show up on a short list for any vacancy that occurs on the Supreme Court. And it's widely expected that there will be some during the upcoming term.
What was his role as a surrogate in the Obama election?
His role was fascinating because it was more than just that he is a close friend of Obama and knows him well. He could also speak as governor of Massachusetts and as the man who replaced Mitt Romney, and could offer a reality check and say, well, this is actually what I found when I took office, and these are the things that have occurred. And he would talk quite a bit about just how well healthcare reform had worked in Massachusetts. There was a phase in the campaign when Governor Romney wanted to talk about anything else, and Governor Patrick not only talked about Romney Care, shall we say, and how successful it was, but they even had a little anniversary party at one point in the year when it marked a specific milestone for the program. And so I think he played, again, that role of here's the view from the home state of the Republican nominee, and we're going to provide this contrast to what the Republican nominee himself is saying about his time in Massachusetts.
You know, on our Vox Pop program, where people call in and give their opinions, somebody called up and took me to task and said that I had referred to the impression on many people's parts that Romney was two-faced. And I thought I was really in for it. And the guy said he was not two-faced, he was seven-faced. So my question to you is, Based on the polling you were doing and the rest of it, was there any evidence that this is one of the things that made people uneasy about Romney?
In our surveys, we were just measuring favorable, unfavorable, but you could see in national surveys, a question we often ask is, does this person mean what he says? And Governor Romney would run into trouble in that kind of polling. People were just very skeptical because we saw these evolutions of issue positions. And in some cases, Governor Romney would say, well, yes, my position has changed. I've thought about this more. More information is available. It's legitimate to change your view. But it was a tough sell because there were so many dimensions on which his views had evolved. I think it hurt his standing in terms of voters and whether they could trust what he said.
Was there any evidence, in the beginning we heard a great deal about the fact that the governor was a Mormon, was there any evidence that it either helped him or hurt him?
I don't think it was a factor. I really don't. It is one of those issues that your opponent can't win, absolutely, by bringing it up because you look crass and divisive. And so I don't think, perhaps the only way it may have come up is when the governor talked about his charitable contributions. Mm. There was the tremendous focus on his tax returns and the amount of money he and his wife gave to charity, the argument being, well, was this given willingly or was this part of a requirement for church membership to tithe? And so it came up in that regard, but I don't think it came up in the way, say, for example, Catholicism came up in John F. Kennedy's race in 1960 and the question, well, to whom do you answer and to what set of values and beliefs are you going to draw on when you're leading this country? We never really saw the issue taken head on like that. And I think the Obama campaign thought there's no benefit, there's no payoff to bringing this up, and so they stayed away from it.
So let me ask you real quickly, do you pollsters watch each other?
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
And if somebody screws up, what happens?
Well, it's not so much that they screw up, but you look and you see, well, what assumptions did this poll rest on, and why are the numbers so different from ours? Because then you go back and you reexamine your own assumptions and your own sample composition. We have to keep in mind margin of error, and so when you see a wide range of predicted outcomes, and it's even unfair to call them that. These are snapshots of a particular moment in time.
What about let me ask you this quickly because we're running out of time. What about corruption? What I mean by that is, what if a major national, well-known pollster with a conservative bent comes out with a deviant prediction, that may be a bad word, but a prediction out of whack with what the other national pollsters are doing? Maybe some people suspected to get the bandwagon effect going for Governor Romney. What would happen in a case like that? Does anybody blow the whistle?
Sure. It's all about transparency, and there is a widely accepted set of practices. We're all members of the American Association for Public Opinion Research, and it's expected that you're utterly transparent in how you've gathered your data, how you've weighted it, how you've analyzed it. And if a survey research firm did not provide that kind of information, that alone is a red flag that something is going on. And if they are a member of our association, they could face censure for it.
Okay, then I have a minute left. Let me ask you specifically about the Gallup organization. They had one poll in which they showed Romney out 5 points. Did your eyes go wide when you saw that?
Oh, there's margin of error, and so that alone didn't make my eyebrows go up, my eyes go wide, but they were also talking about doing half of their interviews on cell phones, and that's something we all have to do because more and more people only have cell phones, but that's a tremendous chunk of your sample to gather over cell phone. It's labor intensive. It's very expensive.
What do you have to do? Just randomly dial cell phone numbers?
That's right. And you have to dial a whole lot more of them, and you have to put a lot more interviewers on the study to get that sample. And we know from previous research from the Pew Research Center that cell phone only folks tend to vote Democratic. And so switching to that half cell phone sample should not have inflated Governor Romney's numbers. If anything, it should have brought the race closer together. And so that was a puzzle. And I think it's one of those things where folks may talk informally. Frank Newport, who runs the Gallup poll, is a great guy, very upfront, sound methodologist. I think when folks see him at professional meetings, they'll pull him aside and say, tell me a little more about this and what went on.
Gotcha. Tim Bresolati, we love having you with us. I could listen and listen and listen. It's just so informative. And thank you so much for being with us. We always count on you.
I enjoyed it. Thank you, Alan.